It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Russian opposition marches in tribute to murdered leader. Tens of thousands of people marched in central Moscow Sunday to mourn the murdered opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Nemtsov was shot and killed in a bridge near the Kremlin while walking home from a restaurant last Friday night. Police are hunting for those responsible for the shooting. He was to have led an anti-war and anti-Vladimir Putin rally in Moscow Sunday. Authorities say North Korea fired two short-range missiles into the East Sea in an apparent protest against joint U.S. and South Korean military exercises launched elsewhere in the region today. South Korea says its military remains vigilant against any additional launches. North Korea has long demanded that Washington and Seoul stop the annual military drills, which Pyongyang has called a dress rehearsal for a northward invasion. An Iraqi coalition of government troops and militias started a highly publicized offensive to push Islamic State militants out of the city of Tikrit. The country's prime minister and commander-in-chief Haider al-Abadi announced the operation Sunday. Mr. Abadi called on Sunni tribal fighters to abandon the IS group. The city has been under IS control since mid-2014. A Syrian watchdog group says 21 Assyrian Christians abducted by the Islamic State have been released. They were elderly men and women. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights made the announcement Sunday. Local militias say at least 150 people were taken when Islamic State militants attacked villages along the Khabur River in northeast Syria last week, overrunning several predominantly Christian towns. This is VOA News. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu arrived in Washington Sunday, 2 days ahead of a controversial speech he plans to deliver before the U.S. Congress. Prior to his departure, Mr. Netanyahu said he was on a historic mission to try to stop a nuclear deal with Iran. VOA's Scott Bob reports.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said it appears that U.S. and European powers have accepted a gradual easing of restrictions on Iran's nuclear program that within a few years could allow Tehran to make a nuclear weapon. He says he cannot accept this. Many U.S. politicians say the negotiations concede too much to the Iranian government, which advocates the destruction of Israel and, they say, backs terrorism around the world. The Obama administration opposes the speech, saying it comes during the Israeli electoral campaign and could be seen as U.S. meddling in Israeli politics. Scott Bob, Jerusalem.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is attempting to shore up the diplomatic friction with Israel. Mr. Kerry told ABC Television's This Week program Prime Minister Netanyahu is welcome to speak in the United States. Secretary Kerry won't be hearing it, though. He's on his way to Europe and Saudi Arabia this week for wide-ranging talks, including discussions about Iran's nuclear program. Three teenage British girls suspected of traveling to Syria to join the Islamic State group have appeared on surveillance video in Turkey. The images show the teens boarding a bus in Istanbul. It is the first reported sighting of the girls since they left London almost 2 weeks ago. Authorities say they have no reason to believe the girls are still in Turkey, but have crossed into neighboring Syria, parts of which have been taken over by the Islamist terror group. The government of Mali has signed a preliminary peace deal with some of the country's northern separatist groups, but the main Tuareg rebel alliance is asking for more time for consultations before agreeing to the accord. Members of the Tuareg Rebel Alliance attended Sunday's signing ceremony in Algiers, the Algerian capital. The UN-brokered deal is aimed at ending decades of instability in northern Mali. Rwanda's Attorney General says the government in Kigali is working with international partners and organizations to go after perpetrators of the country's 1994 genocide. About 800,000 mainly minority Tutsi were killed during the country's 100-day massacre. Attorney General Busingye Johnston says the government will not relent on efforts to ensure victims and survivors of the genocide receive justice. Two American astronauts at the International Space Station completed a two-hour spacewalk, the third such mission in just more than a week. They finished routing 244 meters of power and data lines needed to allow the next generation of spacecraft to dock with a space station. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, March 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations Children's Fund says it believes scores of children abducted by armed men in South Sudan are being used as child soldiers.
We believe a militia group called the Johnson Ohlone Militia, it's a Shilluk militia, took the children on February 15 and February 16. And the militia itself is aligned with the government forces, the SPLA.
John Bald is UNICEF Communication Officer for South Sudan. A Paris tent camp reflects the plight of Europe's asylum seekers from Africa. And a new alleged secretly recorded audio reveals Egyptian president's private thoughts towards Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states.
There is a lot of speculation from pretty reliable sources that these are actually valid recordings. I know that the Sisi government has denied their authenticity, but a number of experts have said that they are actually quite authentic.
Sabab Makmoon is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. President Robert Mugabe celebrated his 91st birthday over the weekend, but critics say the money spent could have been used to improve the nation's ailing economy. And two Senegalese rappers export their entertainment news show to other West African countries. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our final Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says it believes scores of children abducted by armed men in South Sudan in mid-February are being used as child soldiers. John Bard, UNICEF Communication Officer for South Sudan, says hundreds of children preparing for exams were forcefully recruited as soldiers. He said the children were seized by a Shilluk militia aligned with the South Sudan government forces, although the government has denied any connection.
We have become aware that the number of children who were taken about 2 weeks ago is probably in the hundreds. The numbers increased because we became aware through the course of the week that the evidence that children had been taken, more than 89, was overwhelming. Most of these children are not being held in one place. We can establish that, you know, some are in a training camp, some are still in the vicinity or actually in the village where they were taken. When you put together the evidence that we've received from various witnesses and also officials, UNICEF became deeply concerned that not only were there more than 89, I think we believe there's several hundred, but also we believe that many of them may be going off to fight in the very near future.
We have two factions that are fighting a civil war in South Sudan. Who does your organization believe may have taken these children?
We believe a militia group called the Johnson Ohlone Militia, it's a Shilluk militia, took the children on February 15 and February 16. And the militia itself is aligned with the government forces, the SPLA.
Whoever is responsible, what are the possible consequences for that group?
One of the things that UNICEF and its partners are doing, both NGOs and also the UN, is that we are putting together a report for the Grave Violations of Child Rights Monitoring Report. This is an official report that will go back to the United Nations. And we are trying to verify the evidence that we have in order to make the report a lot stronger than it currently is. That's one of the reasons why a special mission went from Malakal, the capital of Upper Nile, where these children were taken, to Malut. And once the team was in Malut, they became very aware of the issue and the fact that these children had in fact been taken. So we are currently preparing that report, and it is a grave violation of child rights, and that will go back to the UN. And hopefully we are going to try and put some sort of pressure on all the factions who have children as soldiers to release them immediately. We believe that there's more than 12,000 child soldiers in South Sudan, and we want those kids out of the army, out of uniform and back in school.
The government spokesman, Atene Wek Atene, has said that the South Sudan government condemned the taking of children. Has this been communicated to UNICEF?
SPLA officials have told us repeatedly that they have no control over the internal workings of this militia, but they do acknowledge that the militia is aligned with the SPLA. And to our knowledge, what is happening up in the Upper Nile says to us that the SPLA itself, although reporting to us that it has no children in it, many of the children are found, in fact, on some of these militias that are aligned with the SPLA.
John Budd is UNICEF Communication Officer for South Sudan. He was speaking with me from Nairobi, Kenya. A new alleged secretly recorded audio reveals Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's private thoughts towards Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. According to one recording, President Sisi allegedly privately despises Arab Gulf leaders despite their generous aid to Egypt. The recordings were aired on Saturday by a Turkey-based Egyptian satellite television channel known for its support for former Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi. Sabah Mahmoud is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. She tells me that although the Egyptian government has denied their authenticity, a lot of experts on Egypt believe the alleged recordings are valid.
Speculation from pretty reliable sources that these are actually valid recordings. I know that the CC government has denied their authenticity, but a number of experts have said that they are actually quite authentic. Of course, we didn't need these leaks to know what is going on, but essentially it establishes several things that a lot of the commentators and observers who follow the Egyptian political scene closely have noted before. One is that A, establish how the military is siphoning off all the aid that the country gets to benefit its own cronies and elites who are in charge. And secondly, it established that, in fact, the Gulf donors who are supporting the Sisi government themselves are A, turning, you know, they're completely turning a blind eye to what Sisi government are doing, but they're also bailing it out at a time when the government itself has done absolutely nothing to improve the economy or solve any of the problems that the country faces.
As you mentioned, probably these recordings are legitimate. In a sense, one respect, Mr. Sisi tend to despise the Arab Gulf states, but he wants their money. In one, it said that he's alleged asking for $10 billion from each of the Gulf states and that this money should go to the military and not the state.
Well, the military is the state, you see. At this point, there is really no difference between the military and the state. Almost all the major portfolios are in the hands of the military. And secondly, those part of the civilian government that used to be part of a Mubarak regime, all of the corrupt leadership is back in power. So essentially, at this point, the military has really expanded its control over the economy.
So what do you think, Professor, what would this do to Mr. Sisi's standing in the country?
You know, what's interesting is that, I mean, on the one hand, it really exposes Sisi for what he is, right? It is the corruption of his regime. And many people have begun to actually question the Sisi's authority. When he first came to power and overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood democratically elected president, there was a moment, almost a year, where there was absolutely no questioning of what Sisi was doing. But at this point, among his supporters, they're realizing that things have not really changed. The country has not improved. And if anything, the political repression of any form of dissent, not just with the Muslim Brotherhood, but of all forms of political dissent, even the liberals have been silenced and put in jails. Given that this new set of recordings that have just been released actually cast doubt for his supporters as well about what the government is up to.
Sabah Mahmoud is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. She was speaking with me from Berkeley, California. Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe celebrated his 91st birthday on Saturday. Political analyst Charles Maganjura says the estimated $1 million spent on the occasion could have been used to prop up the country's ailing economy.
I think that in an economy where, you know, many people are facing, you know, poverty, unemployment and other problems, it's really an indication of our misplaced priorities as a country that we are going to be spending over $1 million celebrating the president's birthday when that money could actually be put to, you know, good use. People don't have running water, people don't have electricity, refuse is not being collected, potholes are all over the place.
At 91, is Mr. Mugabe still capable of ruling the country, Mr. Mangungere?
You know, you have to give it to him. If you look at Mr. Mugabe and compare with other 91-year-olds, you could say he's in that unique position where he has continued to demonstrate, you know, mental presence, you know, physical ability. But to be honest, you know, at 91, one is expected to be retired.
Do you think that Western governments still have confidence in President Mugabe at 91?
I don't think they do. I think that the kind of re-engagement that we have seen, especially with the European Union, I think these people are looking at, you know, a post-Mugabe Zimbabwe and saying to themselves, how best are we going to move forward in terms of our engagement with the government of Zimbabwe?
That was Zimbabwe political analyst Charles Magonjira speaking from Harare with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of VOA Zimbabwe Service. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. Paris is known as the city of lights, but it is also a city of refugees. About 40% of people applying for asylum in France live in the capital, many of them on the streets. The country's treatment of asylum seekers has earned criticism, most recently by the Council of Europe, the continent's top rights body. French lawmakers are now considering legislation to improve the asylum process. Rights advocates say France's shortfalls are reflected across the European Union, where hardening attitudes towards illegal immigration have also hurt those who truly need shelter. For VOA, Lisa Bryant reports from Paris.
About a mile from the city's iconic Montmartre neighborhood is a spot where very few tourists go. It's a busy overpass that houses a collection of small, dirty tents. The metro rumbles overhead. Trains pass below. The residents of this tent camp mostly come from East Africa. Everybody has a different story, but nobody wanted to end up on this bridge with no toilet, no home, and for now, no future. 24-year-old Mikias said he was a student in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa, before leaving his country in 2003.
Why did you leave Ethiopia?
Because we have a political war. Yeah. Like, you know, ethnic group Oromo. Yeah, I am Oromo.
Prazi, who's 25, says he was also a student from Sudan's Darfur region. He says he left because the government harassed him. He crossed the desert to Libya.
Then from Libya, take the boat, take the Mediterranean. And it was just a small boat, and there were a big number of people. And then the boat is broken in the middle of water. And then we had to wait the Guardia Costiera. So they took us to the land. So,
rights advocates have heard these kinds of stories many times before. After Germany, France hosts Europe's largest number of asylum seekers, with around 60,000 applicants. Jean-François Dubost, who's in charge of Amnesty International France's Uprooted Peoples program, says many end up in Paris. That's not the way it's supposed to be. Under French law, asylum seekers are entitled to government accommodations while their claims are processed. The European Union also sets basic standards that governments must meet. But for now, France simply doesn't have enough places to house them. So asylum seekers here are counting on hope and a long wait. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
With schools closed for months due to the Ebola outbreak in Sierra Leone, the country is trying to find other ways to educate children, including daily radio and television programs. But orphans present a particular challenge. Nina DeVries in Freetown reports on the efforts of one local woman who has opened her home to abused women who now use their skills to help teach vulnerable children.
Every day, the children, most of them orphans, are taught subjects like math and English. The resources are basic, a blackboard and no desks, just benches to sit on. But the whole point is to offer kids a better education. Anne-Marie Kalkner is the woman who opened the orphanage in her own home to help children.
I was an orphan, and I went through a lot of child abuse, gender-based violence.
Since then, she has made it her mission to help those less fortunate. Kalkner says that since Cibola struck, she has not been able to have as many children stay with her. There are about 20 orphans who live with her. The others come from single-parent homes and head back there from the orphanage at night to sleep. She says sometimes she can have up to 50 children for classes and free meals. Kalkner says it has always been harder for children to have education because many of them end up selling products on the streets.
Let us see some cats.
It is not just children that Kalkner helps. She is also bringing in young women who have faced difficult situations to teach the classes if they are qualified. Rebecca Kamara is one of those women. She's a teacher but stopped when the school shut down. Then, her mother died from Ebola in November. Kamara's landlord took advantage of that by saying she had to have sex with him if she could not afford to stay in her home.
He did this to me one because I lost my mother. Then two, he asked me to pay my house rent. At that time I was suffering. I didn't have money to pay. Then he forced me to love him.
Kamara ran away after that with her younger brother, and Kalkner found her living on the streets and took her in. Her teaching skills have been a big benefit to the children. The orphanage does not have a radio or TV, so the children can't tune into the education classes the government has created, which airs Monday through Friday. Kamara explains that the informal classroom setting is a nice alternative for people who can't always afford radios or TVs. Kamara adds that through the teaching, she's managed to feel more confident again. Nina DeVries for VOA News, Freetown, Sierra Leone.
After finding success in Senegal, the Journal de Rap, a show where two local rappers sing the news and make political commentary, the founding musicians are now exporting their entertainment news show to other West African countries. The Senegalese rapper and Journal de Rap co-founder Sheikh Sine, known as Kiti, tells Ricky Schreier he hopes the show will find an audience and contribute to democracy and dialogue in more and more West African countries.
We just wanted to reproduce the experience we had here in Senegal in other countries, but we had to choose two countries to begin with. We had Ivory Coast and Niger. Ivory Coast because they just came out, this is long years of political troubles, of war, and now they're reconstructing. One of the main things they need right now is dialogue, you know, and for what happened not to happen again, it is important that the civil society, that artists are expressing themselves, giving their opinion on what is going on in the country, especially in when it comes to politics.
The first episode of Ivory Coast's version of Journal Ape just came out. What was the reception like for the very first episode?
People were surprised. When we talked about the workshops in Abidjan, a lot of people thought that it would be like the Senegalese Journal Rapé. It is somehow. It's a formula. It's just a formula we're applying in Ivory Coast. But then, during the workshops, one of the main things we insisted on is make it yours. Make it sound. Make it in the visuals even. Make it something Ivorian. Because the most important is not the music, the most important is the message when it comes to Journal Rapé. The most important is the role it's going to play, and it's going to play the role of a watchdog, just to give also a different narrative, different from the one which is on traditional media.
So Ivory Coast, you know, they also have an election coming up this year. Is that one reason that you thought the Ivory Coast would be a good country as well to have another Journal Rapé start in?
Actually, when we chose Ivory Coast, we didn't even think of the coming elections because they also got concerns about those things, you know. The issues are really sensitive.
The climate here is a lot more open than some of these other countries, I'd imagine, as well.
Exactly. And, I mean, that's also one of the things we're telling the artists, you know, that we understand that realities are different. We understand that the freedom of speech we got in Senegal maybe is not always in other countries in West Africa. But that's not even the point. The point is just to participate in the work for democracy.
That was Senegalese rapper and Journal Rapé co-founder Sheikh Sine. He was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar. Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sporting here is Marco Uma. In Johannesburg, South Africa, good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. Second half goals scored by Siaka Bagayoko and Ale Male powered Mali to a 2-0 win over South Africa in the finals of the Africa Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger on Sunday. Earlier on at the same venue, Guinea beat FIFA Under-17 World Cup champions Nigeria 3-1 in the bronze medal playoff. Abubakar Toure found the back of the net before Abdoulaye Jules added a brace for Guinea, while Victor James scored for Nigeria. In all, 43 goals were scored in the two-week tournament. Nigerian Victor James is the top scorer with 4 goals. Guinea's Abubakar Toure, Nigerian Kelechi Nwakali, and Mali's Abubakar Traore tie in second place with 3 goals each, while Cameroon's Christian Bayem, Guinea's Abdoulaye Jules, Ivory Coast's Idrissa Doumbia, Malian's Sekou Koita and Ale Male, South African's Eric Mayo and Nelson Maluleke, together with Zambian Patson Daka, each scored 2 goals. In athletics, Robert Chemosin triumphed at the Rome to Ostia half marathon in Italy on Sunday. What's more, his winning time of 59 minutes and 37 seconds is the quickest half marathon in the world this year. Fellow Kenyan Simon Cheprot was second in 59 minutes and 39 seconds, while Godfrey Kisuro was third in a Uganda national record of 59 minutes and 43 seconds. Meanwhile, Ethiopian Amane Beriso and Kenyan Emily Chemutai Ngetich claimed the top 2 spots in the women's race in lifetime bests of 1 hour and 8 minutes and 43 seconds and 1 hour 9 minutes and 13 seconds respectively, as Kenyan Sharon Cherop placed third. Elsewhere, Kenyan Samuel Ndungu clocked 2 hours 9 minutes and 8 seconds to win the Lake Biwa Marathon in Japan on Sunday. Ndungu also won the race in 2012. Finally, Pakistan edged Zimbabwe by 20 runs at the ICC Cricket World Cup in Brisbane, Australia on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, South Africa beat West Indies by 257 runs in Sydney. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, March 2nd. On this day in 1980, Thomas Hitman Hearns won the vacant United States Boxing Association welterweight title. This was one of 5 weight classes that Hearns had won a boxing title, making him the first black to win boxing titles in 5 different weight classes. Also on this day in 1962, Wilt the Stilt Chamberlain scored 100 points in a single basketball game, a professional record that perhaps still stands today. He sunk 36 field goals and 28 foul shots. Chamberlain, who played for the Philadelphia Warriors and 76ers, then the Los Angeles Lakers, was the first scorer and rebounder in the history of the sport, and the first player to score 30,000 points. Chamberlain retired from basketball in October 1974 and was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1979. On this day in 1867, blacks voted in municipal elections in Alexandria, Virginia, for perhaps the first time in the South. The election commissioners refused to count the 1,400 votes, and military officials suspended local elections pending clarifications of the status of the freedmen. And on this day in African history in 1966, Ugandan Prime Minister Apollo Milton Obote arrested 5 of his cabinet ministers, abrogated the constitution, and assumed the presidency in a successful attempt to personally avoid a scandal involving a hidden cache of gold and ivory captured during a revolt in the Congo. Those are your Black History Month and African History Facts for today, March 2nd. Congratulations to Martin Jemlak of Kumba in Southwest Region of Cameroon, Francis K. Alex of the University of Juba in South Sudan, and Mazik Patrick Okorafor of Jos in Plateau State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 27 question, who started the idea to celebrate Black History Month in the United States. The answer, Dr. Carter G. Watson. And that concludes our Black History and African History Contest for 2015. We thank you for listening and participating. We'll see you again in 2016. And that's it for this Monday, March 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton, Washington, hoping that you will make this week a very productive one. Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shomari and his guests discussing the African hospitality. This lighthearted show discusses topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
From Washington.